People who need people is more than a line from a Barbara Streisand song. It's all of us. We are wired for relationships, and when our relationships suffer, there's evidence that our wiring suffers as well. Today's guest has been looking into the parallel functioning of our brains and our relationships, and she puts her findings into a recent book, Four Ways to Click, Rewire Your Brain for Stronger, More Rewarding Relationships. Dr. Amy Banks is the guest. She is the author also. She runs a private practice in the Boston area. She's also the director of advanced training at the Jean Baker Miller Training Institute at the Wellesley Centers for Women. She's previously an instructor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Banks, thanks for joining us today in The Exchange.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Did you write the book because you feel people are not clicking with each other?
I wrote the book because I feel like people don't necessarily know how to click with people in a way that actually sustains them physiologically. How about that?
Physiologically. So it really is a connection. I mean, the better our relationships are doing, the better we are doing as
exactly.
Creatures.
That's right. And I think when you're in a culture or a system that doesn't necessarily put a premium on kind of interdependence, or that really doesn't stand out for people, then I think people don't get the message of how critical healthy relationships are to our health and well-being, not just to our kind of psyche, but to our physical health, that people who are isolated literally die earlier, get sicker.
Our culture is kind of indistinct on this point, though, isn't it? Because, I mean, on the one hand, yes, there are lots of arguments about, you know, rugged individuals and I'm fine by myself and you know, various country western songs. But then there's also the other songs about how much I miss my woman, how much I miss my man, you know, need the person next to me, all that sort of thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's really such a kind of split personality, if you will, around, you know, what are we supposed to be hyper-individual or are we supposed to be interdependent? And I think, you know, most people would say, and I, you know, whenever I talk to groups around the country and I ask them about, you know, what's a healthy individual, they usually describe the person who is able to sort of stand on their own, that's sort of some innate measure of maturity.
Huh. So we by on the flip side of that, do we consider it somewhat immature to want to be around other people?
Well, some people do. I mean, think of all of the movements afloat, like codependency. I mean, the words that get thrown about where being needy or dependent and all those tend to have a lower value, let's just say, on the scale of functioning.
And so, Amy, once you get past the introduction, the very first sentence in the book is boundaries are overrated, which is bound to make a few people go, huh?
Exactly.
What do you mean by that?
Yeah, well, which was somewhat my point. I was hoping that people would go, hmm? But also, I really mean it literally. In a society that really is built around separating and individuating, right, that idea of kind of a boundary or a wall between two people serves a very useful function, right? It keeps that other person far enough away so that their feelings, their thoughts, their beliefs, and all of that don't kind of leak into you, right? You can stay very clear about yourself. The problem with that is that it actually doesn't exist, right? That what the neuroscience is showing us, and, you know, I think the mirror neuron system, or the way that we resonate with people unconsciously, spontaneously, literally by mimicking them in our own internal neurological pathways, right? That's how we understand people, sort of throws that idea of boundaries right out the window. And so I think rather than trying to talk the words of boundaries and walls, we really need to talk about interfaces between two people and how in the world do we learn how to navigate that space between two people. So really think more about sort of a porous membrane where you are always kind of in your reality and beliefs and all that are always leaking into me in some way, and that's actually the way we're built, right? So really strategizing about how to do it, how to identify it, how to figure out what's my feeling, what's your feeling, all of that are actually very crucial relational skills.
But knowing where you stop and the other person begins is an important thing, isn't it?
Of course, of course. Yeah, and what I talk about that in a relationship way and how we do at the Jean Baker Miller Training Institute, where this theory sort of grew and developed, is the idea of clarity, right, and differentiation. you know, that, you know, to know kind of, it's not even so much where I stop and you start or what have you, but to get a, to have a clear sense of your own belief systems, but also to have a really clear and accurate sense of the other person that you're in a relationship with.
You used the term neuroscience a couple moments ago, and I know we've used it a lot in a couple of different discussions over the last several years, and I see that there seems to be the beginnings, anyway, of a backlash against it. When we talk about neuroscience, what are we talking about?
Well, you know, really, neuroscience is the science of neurons. Neurons are the functioning cells that exist in the central nervous system. So at its basics, that's what we're talking about. You know, I think neuroscience, the problem with neuroscience is that you've got this enormously complex organ system, the central nervous system. And I think people that are, quote, trying to you know, kind of make applications out of the information that's being found out, have to, in a sense, reduce some of it, right? Otherwise, the complexity would be too overwhelming. It wouldn't be helpful. So I think people worry that the neuroscience, that we're getting ahead of ourselves, basically, that, you know, that the science doesn't necessarily support on every level what the claims are claiming.
Within the realm of what we know now, though, I mean, is it fair to say that our brains seem to wither a bit from not being connected to other people?
Yeah, and not just our brains, but our pathways. And I break down the pathways of connection into these four pathways of connection that we may touch on through the course of the conversation. You know, and sort of pull those out from some of the other brain pathways that we have. Of course, they're always kind of integrated in the whole brain, but particularly those areas, if you're not in good, healthy relationship, the pathways that are needed to form relationships actually don't get the stimulation they need. And I think there are some things that people don't that believe that use it or lose it, that you need to keep stimulating the brain to keep it good and strong. Those pathways.
All right. Use it or lose it. I was waiting for the phrase.
Yeah.
Either one of us was going to say it. You got there first.
Yeah.
Amy Banks is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. She's an MD, a psychiatrist, a therapist, and the author of Four Ways to Click, Rewire Your Brain for Stronger, More Rewarding Relationships. We'll talk about what those four ways are. Think of the acronym CARE. We'll explain that when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange with your phone calls and emails in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about your brain on relationships. Dr. Amy Banks, a psychiatrist working in the Boston area, has written a book called Four Ways to Click, Rewire Your Brain for Stronger, More Rewarding Relationships. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the brain and its pathways and how we make use of those to make not only our brain stronger, but our relationships as well. And maybe one goes before the other. We'll figure that out. Join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. 800-838-3760. Send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Amy, you mentioned mirror neurons a few moments ago, and can you tell us a story about the F5 part of the brain and the study at the University of Parma?
Yeah, I can. It's really one of those fascinating kind of happenstances that happen in medicine all the time. Basically, some Italian researchers were looking at the area F5 in monkey brains. Now, this was an area that they knew was responsible, if you will, for the for literally just sticking out your arm to grasp something. So it was like the grasp, not reflex, but movement. And so that was kind of isolated in the monkey brain. And one day in the lab, somebody was reaching for something, and they noticed that that area of the brain that was being monitored actually stimulated, if you will, in the brain of the monkey. And that was like completely new information. It wasn't that the monkey's arm was moving. It was the other a person's arm that was moving. And what that told them as they sort of did it over and over again, and then people really began to expand out into, you know, other actions, other feelings, other sensations, is that your brain has this mirror neuron system that literally mimics what other people are feeling, doing, intending to do or, you know, sensing in order to understand them so that, you know, it's that intuitive sense of knowing another person literally is happening in your own nervous system as you interact.
So this sounds like the roots of empathy in humans.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I think those studies have certainly been done, that it happens for humans. Yes, it happens exactly the same way. And in fact, there are pathways that connect sort of brain areas for performing an action, you know, crying, the facial experience of crying down through the insula, this area of your brain, into your own visceral system or gut system so that we actually feel what somebody else feels.
Now, your clinical work is in RCT, relational cultural theory, which it sounds like certainly is based on the idea of empathy. Tell us a bit about how it works.
Well, relational cultural theory has been around for about 40 years. It was started at the Stone Center at Wellesley College. And basically, what a group of women here started talking about was it was challenging the notion that the goal of human development actually was towards separating and individuating, which was all of the rage, you know, and certainly in the 70s, and still is to a large extent. And they said, you know what, I think that's wrong. I think relationships are central. And not only are relationships central to all human growth and development, but the cultural context in which relationships are embedded are also critical. And so, you know, as we've moved forward and neuroscience has entered the picture and we think about how people's are shaped and formed in their behaviors, we really see that this was really prophetic, if you will, that relationships are central to human growth and development. And in fact, the cultural context, right, the other relationships in our lives, the stressors and all of that, act as shapers or neuroplastic changers, literally, of our nervous system.
So in therapy based on relational cultural theory, is there a greater emotional bond or of something?
There is certainly a greater emphasis on the relationship. So where somebody might come in and, you know, have complicated relationships or trouble with their family of origin, say, you know, the mother or what have you, you know, one school of thought that says you need to separate and individuate would say, okay, the problem is you're too close and dependent in that relationship and that person has no boundaries, and they would recommend that you try to separate further, right? Get away from it. And what a relational therapist would talk about is, okay, that's a relationship that's very important to you, but what you need to learn is how to interact healthy. How do you shape that? Because the way that you are shaping each other is actually in a very disconnecting, stressful way. Let's learn how to relate in a way that actually is healthy.
Amy Banks, MD, is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Four Ways to Click, Rewiring Your Brain for Stronger, More Rewarding Relationships. So let's move into the four ways that are the title essence of the book, and again, it comes down to an acronym: CARE, calm,
yep,
accepted, resonant, energetic. So let's start with calm. This is the domain of the vagus nerve?
Yeah, so the smart vagus nerve was identified by Steve Porges at the University of Chicago, and what he found, most people think about the autonomic or the automatic nervous system. It's that part of our nervous system that's operating kind of in the background all the time and helping us deal with life as the sympathetic fight or flight response, and the parasympathetic, which is the sort of freeze response, and that we sort of go back and forth between sympathetic and parasympathetic to handle life's stressors, okay? And what Steve Porges did is he identified a whole new, literally evolutionarily, pathway in mammals that innervates the muscles in your face, right? So the muscles that help you smile, raise your eyebrows, those muscles in your inner ear that when you're listening, when you're attuned to somebody, they move, the muscles in your throat, in your neck. And what this whole pathway, the smart vagus, is for is to help modulate the stress response system in healthy relationships. So if you think about it, you go out into the world, and if you see somebody that is safe, right, a friend, a colleague, what have you, or somebody that seems non-threatening, you usually kind of brighten up, you smile, your eyes go up, you know, and as that's happening, a signal is sent to your sympathetic nervous system saying, you know, stand down, you're not needed, and you get a sense of feeling calm.
Interesting. So if the relationship is causing you to feel tense, there's probably something wrong with the relationship.
You got it. That's right. And that and something you need to pay attention to, right? So there may be something. Of course, people that have exaggerated stress response systems, you know, and that can happen if you've been if you've grown up in an abusive home or, you know, in a place with lots of violence or whatever, you can have situations where you're so kind of on edge, right? Your sympathetic nervous system has been so bulked up that it's hard to get the smart vagus in there, right? It gets kind of imbalanced.
There are some interesting comparisons in here to cold-blooded creatures, you know, reptiles, amphibians, and the like, and the differences just in the ways in which they procreate and scatter throughout the world. Very different with mammals, though. I mean, we really do physically depend on each other a lot.
You got it. And you think about the difference if you've ever had a pet turtle or a reptile where, you know, they basically produce a lot of young, those young have all the instincts to go out in the world, and they just kind of scurry off, right? We don't do that. We have these little babies that are totally dependent. They have these reflexes to connect, but they're totally dependent. I've often thought about humans as being almost like marsupials, right? We have to, like kangaroos or koalas, where you have to keep them in that relational pouch so that their nervous system really is formed and grows within that. And left to their own devices, they would die. Literally.
I was talking about this with somebody recently. We were talking about other primates. I mean, how soon before, for example, a chimpanzee can be out on its own?
You know, I don't know the years, but it's an extended period of time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you see them, right? I was just literally in the San Diego Zoo, and it was a gorgeous mountain gorilla mother, you know, just carrying this little one on its back, on its arm. It was just attached all the time, and that's really what humans do.
They really do, but the bigger issue is that we depend on each other for so long. I mean, a five-year-old human can't do anything really by him or herself versus
right.
a five-year-old of many other even primate species.
Exactly.
Dr. Amy Banks, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Four Ways to Click, Rewire Your Brain for Stronger, More Rewarding Relationships, about the interrelations between our relationships and the functions of our brain. We seem to do a lot better when our relationships are doing better. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Join the discussion at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So we're talking again about the four ways, spelling care: calm, accepted, resonant, and energetic. We just talked about care. Now, accepted involves the, here we get into more tricky structures in the central nervous system, the dorsal anterior cingulate cortex.
Yeah, that's a lot of brain words that aren't as important as what it is. And what it is a strip of brain that's an alarm system in your brain. And what we now know is that when you are socially excluded, when you're pushed out of whatever your group is, this area lights up and causes distress, right? And when researchers looked about what else they knew about that area of the brain, they found that this area also registers the distress of physical pain. And what that tells us is that when we're socially excluded, you know, by social exclusion, it means, you know, someone, you know, pushing us out, being mad, furious at us, but it's also, I think, all of the isms, racism, homophobia, all of those things. When we feel excluded from the human community, it registers in our body exactly the same as if we had some illness or injury.
So social pain and physical pain register pretty much the same.
It's the same thing for human beings because we're social animals. And then you begin to see where the data line up about people who are more isolated or people in marginalized groups tend to get sicker more frequently.
Which is one of the major arguments that people are making against solitary confinement in prison.
You got it,
even
exactly.
If people need to be punished, they don't necessarily need to be made insane,
right.
Which is what we're talking about here.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Tell us about the game of cyberball that the UCLA scientists set up. That's part of this chapter.
Yeah, cyberball has been a way that people have studied social rejection. And as I say it, I'm sure all of the listeners and you are going to hear, well, this isn't much of a social rejection. Basically, what they do is they have research subjects come in, sit down at a computer, and they're playing cyberball. They have on their computer screen some of those little puffy white men or women, and you push a button and you play that you toss a ball to someone else. Allegedly, the other person is in another room, and the three people are playing catch with the ball. And then slowly what happens is the subject that's being studied is left out. And so, you know, think about it. It's not a big investment there. But what they found was that even with that level of social rejection or being left out of a game, they monitored for how distressed the person got and then what area activated. And what they found was most people, even in this kind of mild social exclusion, felt distressed, actually. Those who felt more distressed had more activity in this area of the dorsal anterior cingulate, so it correlated with that.
So even though there was no physical ball involved, just getting excluded from this virtual game gave them the same sense of exclusion.
Exactly.
Wow.
Yeah. That's how tightly wired we are to being a part of, right?
Absolutely. All right. So that was common, except that now we're down to resonant in the CARE acronym.
Yeah. So resonance is your ability to read other people's actions, intentions, sensations, and feelings. We talked about it. That really is the work that a number of researchers have been doing on the mirror neuron system, and the idea that we just read other people by internally resonating or mimicking them in our own central nervous system.
And so there's a pen in the mouth exercise that you lay out here that's one of several fascinating examples of things that people do or that stops us from doing what we're meant to do.
Yeah, exactly. So imagine, if part of what this has been so specific that people have been able to see that, like, for me, if I'm talking with somebody, I'm looking at them and my brain is forming those same words with my mouth. Okay, now I'm not doing it. You can't see it externally, but the same area that would be forming those words in my motor area for speech are actually firing. So it's like somebody's talking to me. I'm repeating what they're saying, in a sense, in my head. And if you put a pencil in somebody's mouth so that you sort of freeze up those muscles, right, and they can't move, then you actually have a harder time understanding them.
So even when we're mimicking talking, the brain can't hear as well?
That point, essentially you can't move. It's sort of like those areas are frozen. You can't mimic in the same way, and so you actually don't understand. And in fact, I'll tell you what the parallel is that people might relate to more is that they've found that people who get Botox injections actually can't read other people as clearly.
What?
Because you literally paralyze part of those muscles. Botox is something that freezes the muscles in a sense, right? And it smooths out. You don't have the wrinkles, but you also don't have the movement to make internally the same kind of facial expressions. And so it's harder for you to read other people's feelings.
So if somebody's got a flexible enough face that you can see by, you know, their eyebrows moving up what they're feeling, and if your eyebrows can't move as well because you're on Botox, you just can't feel what they're feeling?
You don't feel it in the same way.
Wow.
Yep. Yeah.
That's a lot of interconnection between the physical and the emotional.
That is a lot of interconnection. That's part of what the book is telling you is that, you know, your nervous system is like an information processing center, right? And all of this stuff you are picking up, we are so finely attuned to other people that it's we're just reading them and picking up signals from these social groups all the time.
Now, the signals are going to be weaker and stronger depending on the individual, it seems like. We talk about people who are naturally very empathic and some who are not.
That's right.
In the most extreme circumstances, though, it sounds like we still, I think as you put it, we're getting a taste of the other person's feelings, but not the whole meal.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I would say.
All right. So the introduction of empathy in therapy, for example, though, I mean, how controversial is that in the field right now?
Well, right now, you know, fortunately over the last, I would say, 10 or 15 years, it has become more and more central. Now, you know, if you're in the field of therapy, you'll see that there's still a pretty big divide between cognitive behavioral therapy, right, mm-hmm. and sort of this interpersonal therapy. I personally think you need both. The cognitive therapists are using the tenets of use it or lose it, right, to try to kind of shape behavior, shape thinking. But I feel like, you know, they're at a disadvantage if they're not also using the relationship piece, because when somebody is connected, and it actually brings us to the E part of the care program, which is energy, and which is the dopamine reward system. So when you're learning something new, whether it's a behavior, you know, an emotion, a math problem, you're literally changing your brain structure, and you need to repeat, right? You need to do it over and over again. And dopamine tends to be a chemical in your body that sort of solidifies new pathways together, new learning systems. And one of our greatest sources of dopamine in what's called the dopamine reward system is actually healthy relationships, right? So we're built so that when we connect with somebody else, we get sort of a hit of dopamine, which gives us motivation and energy and pleasure to keep connecting, right?
All right, much more to talk about with Amy Banks, MD. Her book is Four Ways to Click, Rewire Your Brain for Stronger, More Rewarding Relationships. We're talking about the acronym CARE, Calm, Accepted, Resonant, and Energetic. We just got into energetic. We'll explore that further with Amy Banks, and we'll take your phone calls and emails as well. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Amy Banks and you in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Dr. Amy Banks. She's a psychiatrist and a therapist in practice in the Boston area, the director of advanced training at the Jean Baker Miller Training Institute at the Wellesley Center for Women, Wellesley Centers for Women, previously an instructor of psychiatry at the Harvard Medical School. Her new book is Four Ways to Click, Rewire Your Brain for Stronger, More Rewarding Relationships. We're talking about the four ways under the CARE acronym, Calm, Accepted, Resonant, and Energetic. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the ways in which our relationships help us in many ways, just in general, to be human beings. 800-838-3760 around the region, and our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So we've covered a lot about the ways in which body, emotions, relationships all hook together. And as we've gone through this, I've been trying to think about the effect on the actual thinking part of the brain. I mean, it stands to reason if you're in an abusive sort of situation growing up and your concerns are really about survival, you're not going to be focusing on the broader, deeper thoughts of life. But if your life is just generally okay, but your relationships are just kind of okay, is your brain just not developing as the optimum instrument it could be, even for the thinking parts of things, not just the emotional parts?
Yeah, it's a great question. If your relationships are just kind of average,
right?
So because what I would say is a whole lot about thinking, right? I mean, certainly you can overthink things, but a lot of people in neuroscience and meditation, all that, really are talking about integration, right? And the ways that the different areas of your brain kind of communicate with each other. And I think this relationship piece and these neural pathways for relationship, what they do is they allow, when you have the healthy relationships, they allow you to feel safe, because the biggest thing that gets in the way of our thinking is not feeling safe and, you know, kind of turning to the stress response system, which, you know, will kind of flip the lid on the frontal cortex, which is really, you know, sort of your thinking cognition area, right? You go more with your basic instinct. So, you know, I think what you see with a lot of people who have just relationships is they may not be in abusive relationships, but they have a kind of a chronic smoldering level of stress that actually gets in the way of thinking.
So we've talked many times about the stress hormone cortisol. Does that tend to be higher in people who have less well-functioning relationships? Do we know about that much?
Yeah, you know what? That's a very good question. I know certainly in people that have you know, abuse relationships, yes. But I don't know actually the data on, you know, relationships and cortisol levels. I'm not going to say that because I don't want to go out on a limb. We certainly know that a lot of things, you know, we do know that the stress response system is turned off when you're in safe relationships. So I guess by definition, then that would decrease the cortisol because that comes along to, it's like the anti-stress hormone.
Okay, back to the key of energetic, the dopamine reward system. Where does dopamine come from? Is there a particular structure in the brain or central nervous system?
Yeah, dopamine. So dopamine, there are a number of different pathways in the brain that use dopamine, and so you'll hear it related to the basal ganglia area in Parkinson's, and so that controls smooth muscle movements. And so when you get low dopamine there, you get some of that rigidity. It's also there's a pathway. You know, it starts there in the limbic system. There's also a pathway that goes out into the frontal cortex, and that pathway is all about cognition with dopamine. But what the one we're talking about here is really that reward system, and that is it's called the ventral tegmental area deep in the brain that really is there literally to give you a reward when you do something healthy, right, so that you keep doing it. And for people who relationships are crucial in the beginning, right, and throughout life to keep that relationship dopamine pathway alive. I think one of the things that happens in our culture when we devalue relationships and we have people move away from relationships, they go to other ways to stimulate their dopamine. And the other ways could be drugs and alcohol, can be shopping, can be pornography. I mean, there's so many ways to kind of get that hit, if you will.
And so again, we're just trying to replace the dopamine that we're not getting because we're not finding pleasure in other things.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
We have some calls here. Let's go to Julie in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. Amy Banks. Her book is Four Ways to Click. Hi, Julie.
Oh, hello there. I have three questions. The first one is, what do you call this field of study, and is it a vocational field that you actually can treat individuals? And here's the third question. Where would you get a degree in it, and how long might it take? Where is best to start for something like this?
It sounds like you're interested in this field, Julie.
I know, and I'd love a new vocation.
Right.
Go back to that.
Well, so let me say this. So the program, we've talked about the CARE assessment. I mean, we haven't talked about the CARE assessment. We talked about the CARE and the neural pathways. The book, Four Ways to Click, actually has an assessment tool where you can assess the relationships in your life. I actually talk to people about it. It sort of will make your relational world pop up in 3D, and that in and of itself is often helpful to really see the quality of the relationships and how they're shaping your pathways. And you can look and, you know, find a value of those pathways. How are yours doing? So the book is not just telling you the story about neuroscience. It's also telling you how you can actually use that information to change your brain and change your relationships. Once you do the assessment, there actually are relationship exercises in there that can actually stimulate these areas of your brain. So the first thing I wanted to point out is that the book has all of that. Relational cultural theory, the place that I would urge everybody to go to if you're interested in this, I want you to go to a website that is jbmti.org. It stands for the Jean Baker Miller Training Institute. It's at Wellesley College, at the Wellesley Centers for Women. And we have, you can go through our webpage. We have lots of publications. We have home studies. We run institutes twice a year. We have one coming up in the summer in June. I run webinar courses throughout the year. In fact, I have a four-series webinar on this book, The Four Ways to Click, to help people understand it and use it. That is on the website. You can register for that there. And the other thing that's on our website is this is a theory that, you know, started here at Wellesley, but has really spread into a lot of different venues really all around the world. There's a nursing school on the coast of California that's literally built around RCT. There are a couple of universities that you can go and get a degree that focuses on relational cultural theory, and the neuroscience will be a part of that. One is at St. Scholastica in Duluth, one's at St. Mary's in San Antonio, Texas. So it's, and again, all of this information you can find on the website, as well as connections to myself, Judy Jordan, who's the director of the Institute, Maureen Walker, who's at Harvard Business School and is also instrumental in spreading this information.
All right. Thanks.
I hope that's helpful.
Yeah, thanks for the question, Julie. Appreciate that question. Let's go to Sandy in Mount Shasta. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. Amy Banks.
Yeah, hi. Wow. Amy, I'm so glad to discover yet another in a growing list of psychologists and researchers and authors like yourself who recognize that so many of our individual and cultural issues, and by issues I really mean problems,
yeah, right,
the result of a lack of connection.
Yeah.
And
yep.
I did enough research online. I ordered your book, and I know I'll be recommending it.
Thank you.
I do want to ask you a question about something I didn't find in your book.
Yep.
I'm completely on board with everything you've said, and I was curious about this thing that I'm going to call an omission right now. But
mm-hmm.
I want to ask it because my own reading and experience, and I work here in early childhood education and child
sure.
development,
yep.
has left me convinced that the capacity for making satisfying human connections is totally related to attachment.
Yeah.
And yet I didn't find the word in your book. And I was doubly puzzled because Dan Siegel is somebody I consider who, if I see his name on a book, it's like the Good Housekeeping Seal.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah.
And I love you. I'm so glad you gave us this resource of this website. I'm already there and
going
to be all over this. So why did you not talk about attachment in your book?
Well, it's so interesting. It's fascinating that you even point that out. It never occurred to me. I mean, I think of all of the work that I do as being absolutely embedded and simpatico with attachment theory. You know, in my mind, what I've described throughout my book is the ways that attachments literally build this nervous system. So it's interesting. You're right. I haven't used that particular word, but I believe that I've described that throughout the book. It's interesting. And attachment theory, I certainly, use a lot of that in my work with traumatized folks. I think that's probably not a helpful answer, other than to say.
So you're all about it, but you just haven't used the term.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. I didn't. Yeah.
Yeah. And I giggled a little bit when Sandy was first on because Sandy has made it clear that we're making him poor because he buys a lot of the books that that people talk about when they come on the program, particularly in
that's
this field.
Funny. Yeah.
Let's take another call. Thank you, Sandy, from Jim in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. Amy Banks.
Yes, very quickly. Your previous call, I would put it this way. The word relationship just in itself from 11 years old to 81 years old, automatically guy-gal comes on. It's unavoidable. I have known many, many, many people that form many relationships from junior high through, well, I'll be 74 in a couple of months,
mm-hmm.
with groups, societies, everything, to not get a, as I think your caller said, would call it an attachment. They are the joiners, they are the politicians, everything, but not a really good, quote, relationship.
Yeah, yeah, and I think that's absolutely right. I mean, one of the meta messages in the book is absolutely that there are qualities to a healthy relationship that are needed to sustain these pathways for connection and allow you to get the full benefit of the physiology of connection, right? It's not simply attachment, and it's really about healthy connection.
I'm curious about the specific connections in your lives, in our lives. You talk about the care assessment in the book, and I'm looking at the one that's in here, the example for Maggie's care relational assessment chart. Yeah, I would imagine you want to be somewhat careful about who you share this with, because you're essentially rating relationships in numbers, aren't you?
Sure, yeah. Yeah, yeah, you are rating relationships, or you're rating, you know, you're rating your experience of interactions in these relationships and numbers. And, you know, it's simply a quantitative way for you to kind of get your head around the quality of these relationships. And that's really what it's meant to do. It's not a judgment tool. It's not a, you know, and I say, I know once or twice in the book, regardless of the numbers, you know, don't throw away any relationships unless they're frankly abusive, right? You know, all relationships can be worked on, and all relationships, regardless of the trouble, you know, it takes two people to form them. So I do hear the discomfort around judging it, and, yeah, you don't want to pin it up on your Facebook page, but I think it can provide useful information for people.
It seems like it's probably also necessary to remember that relationships are going to be of different depth and quality anyway. You know,
absolutely. Yeah. They're going to be in different depth and quality. And, you know, one of the other things I tell people, caution them when they're doing their assessment is, you know, don't do it when you're acutely dysregulated. Don't you know, sit down at a time when you're, you know, when you're relatively kind of in a good space, or, you know, not particularly stressed out about something, because that's going to shape, as stress always does, your perception of everything.
So don't do a revenge rating, for example. Sit down and
exactly.
Rate your relationship with your loved one when you just had a fight.
Exactly, right? Because that, you know, boom, you're then your thinking brain, you're not integrated in your assessment of this relationship. You've gone offline and you're doing an amygdala or a limbic system assessment of the relationship only.
The ways in which the brain, the parts of the brain work together, the brain with the body, they're all very fascinating, as brought forward in the book. It's called Four Ways to Click, Rewire Your Brain for Stronger, More Rewarding Relationships. Amy Banks, MD, wrote it with the help of Leanne Hirschman. Amy, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Happy to be here.
Great to
have
you.
Have a good day.
You too.